Welcome once again. That's a lot of noise and stuff we just made. So for people just coming for the first time, Wednesday nights are not usually like this. It's just a special event. And as you maybe got the gist, it's this group of 12 people are embarking on what we're calling warming the jewel, which is 1 year of committed practice to zazen and discussions and meetings and ceremonies and retreats and so on. And it's a new program starting right now. We don't know what will happen, but it will hopefully go on for the next year like that. And we're starting a practice period, which some people have filled out forms that say they're coming to certain events, and for those who haven't, you're welcome and included in this 9 weeks of just maybe more events and more people around during this time. The idea of the practice period is that it can benefit everyone. And it seems to be all about commitments. We've been talking so much about commitments. I heard one teacher say recently something like, there's a big difference between commitment and devotion. That commitment is often something we feel like we have to do, that's kind of a burden, and it's a way to go unconscious. He was being pretty strong about it. It's like making a commitment makes us go unconscious, because we just, okay, I'm going to do this no matter what, and either we fail or we just plug along through it, and just because we said we were going to, as opposed to just actually being present and responding to the situation. Whereas devotion sounds very similar, but devotion has this quality of you're just throwing yourself into the situation of the present. And it may be based on various factors and conditions, like having said that you're committed to certain events and so on. But the spirit is more like, well, I said that and I was a different person when I said that, but now I'm this person and all of the conditions are going into this present moment, and a response can come forth, and we can hold back or we can wholeheartedly pour our life energy into the response of the moment. So something like that is how I would think of as devotion. So maybe commitments can help us make more of a devoted spirit. And if we're not paying attention, they can make us go unconscious and get dull and resentful. Also, I was thinking about these I call vertical and horizontal aspects of our practice, which there's many ways that we could talk about that, but one would be that, like, vertical is like through time. So the vertical dimension of practice is we recite the names of all these ancestors in our lineage, and we honor all these ancient ways and traditions, like these ceremonies tonight. Although we adapted them to this space and this community, they're basically very ancient traditions, the way we did all of that. It's not just made up out of the blue. And that's why it might feel kind of weird to do things like walk around the room kind of bent over like that. It came from China in like the 8th century or something, passed along through Japan and down to us, and we do these things. And if, as we do them more, they feel more like they're our own ceremonies. Maybe I have that experience. But we might question, why do it that way? Why don't we come up with something else, or nothing at all? Why any of this ritual expression of ancient times? But that's the vertical dimension. And the horizontal dimension would be like this moment, like across the universe, not based on any past precedents at all, but just responding to the conditions of the moment with no preconceived notions. We could call that one part of the horizontal aspect of our practice. And it's the creativity comes in here, and the freshness, and how do we adapt this ancient Asian tradition to modern America in downtown Santa Cruz. This is essential. And I would propose that both these, the vertical and the horizontal aspects, are essential. And if we fall into one side or the other, we lose our way. In other words, if we throw out all the old tradition and just start making it up fresh, and people try this. People who've been steeped in the tradition a long time sometimes throw the whole thing out, or as much as they can. It's maybe impossible to throw it all out. You know, as far as meditation groups, people usually at least keep the some form of silent meditation. But maybe they throw out any particular posture and any particular schedule and using bells and things like that. And then it becomes something new. And then maybe their students carry on their way and it becomes vertical again. So we need the fresh creativity to respond to changing circumstances. But I think a point that's often not given its due is this vertical element of learning something from centuries of way things being done in a particular way that carries deep meaning that's often not revealed except by doing it over and over. So, I don't know, in the American Zen world, maybe Santa Cruz Zen Centers, maybe tonight anyway, we're leaning towards the vertical side doing such ceremonies. But I think we have a lot of innovative and fresh responses here too. It's maybe impossible to completely avoid either. So it's just something to think about as an organization, but in our own personal practice too. How much do we lean towards one side or the other? We could also look at another dimension of the vertical, horizontal grid that, you know, maybe if you put a vertical and horizontal line together, it covers everything. It extends in all directions into space. And they meet, vertical and horizontal meet at one point. And you could say that's the point, you know, where they meet is shifting all the time, but that's our life and how to keep a balanced meeting. But this, another aspect would be, vertical would be kind of like hierarchical, and horizontal would be like equal. And so I think some people express some concern around doing something like this kind of a ceremony where we don't usually do this, where we say, okay, this group is doing this program and they're going to walk around, and but it's a particular group, it's not like everybody in the room, and that people can feel uncomfortable with that. Like, it starts to, we're more comfortable with the equality horizontal part, and Zen teaching is so much emphasizes that. I think it has both elements, but I think what we're often drawn to practices like this is it's promoting and nurturing this the horizontal heart of life, where we share something, we're deeply all connected, and we're all basically the same at the source. And in terms of mind, there's no separation at all. We're completely, we are each other, actually. And yet, there seems, I think there's some value in saying, okay, these people are deciding to do this particular practice for this year. So some of the people in the group even said, maybe we don't really need to do this ceremony, do we? We'll just sort of secretly be practicing in this committed or devoted way. And I felt like, but I want to honor what you're making this major effort to practice this way for a year. And I feel like wanting to honor it in some way. And so then we have these vertical ceremonies to enact such honoring. So I don't have any particular point to make about all this, just that I think it's good to keep in mind these two elements of our practice, and if it starts to fall into one or the other, to remind each other of that. And this practice period, these 9 weeks, we're having a class series on the Buddha's teachings of mind only. So I want to emphasize, because our time is short, 9 weeks will go by very quickly. I want to emphasize in these talks and this sesshin, this retreat that begins tomorrow, we'll have talks as well. Let's really start taking up these teachings of mind only. Mind only, or in Sanskrit, citta matra, is a, you could say, a philosophical school of tenets from old India in Mahayana Buddhism. So it refers to this unique system of a system for studying our experience. So here we have the vertical and horizontal again. It's an ancient vertical system with all these old sutras and teachings. But it's the whole point of it is about studying our life right now. It's not about studying how those people like Vasubandhu looked at their lives at that time. They help us, and I think they had this in mind, that this is not culture bound, this is not time bound. These are universal teachings about mind and the nature of mind. And I personally feel like they're very applicable. And I'm one who's drawn to look at the source of these teachings, to go to the old sutras. And I think people put a lot of devotion and time and energy into creating these teachings. They meditated on them their whole lives, it looked like, and then they had whole universities practicing with these teachings and debating each other and refining their way of putting these very subtle teachings into words. And then miraculously we have them translated into English now. And so I think we have to keep it accessible enough, because it can get very complicated sometimes, but I think we have to stay true to the source and not, at least I don't want to water it down, these teachings. It's easy to just say, well, yeah, mind only, right? Everything is mind. I mean, we've heard that before, and that's easy enough to understand. And on one level, it is, that everything we experience is our own mind's version of it. I mean, even if you've never heard of Buddha, Dharma, probably most people would agree with, in terms of our experience, the way we experience the world is through the lens of our own mind. It's not the same for anybody. And that's basically the basis of this school of thought. But then there's this whole web of system to cover all the bases, we could say, and become more and more clear, conceptually clear, about what is our experience, basically. And sometimes we might even call this mind-only school the like experience school, the school of personal and direct experience. And then we have this framework that we can examine it through. So even though this is a later innovation, the Buddha in ancient India in one of his maybe earliest teachings that we know of, the Dhammapada, classic teaching of the Buddha. Historically, they say some things maybe weren't written by the Buddha or spoken by the Buddha, but they think that the Dhammapada is one of the most historically accurate to what the Buddha actually said. Really old type of language. And the first verse in the Dhammapada, the classic teaching of the Buddha, says something like, all phenomena, all things, all dharmas, all phenomena are preceded by mind, born of mind and made of mind. That's the first line. So, in these very early teachings, that was some of the Buddha's words. All phenomena are preceded by the mind and actually made of mind. So it's teachings like that that later Indian teachers collected and refined into what we now call the mind-only school. A classic metaphor from this mind-only tradition is that of water being perceived differently by different beings. So even within the human realm, like here's a cup of water, we, you know, if we saw this water, or tasted it, we would all have a slightly different experience of it. But because we're all humans, it's somewhat similar. But fish, for example, if you show a fish, if you have a little goldfish, you drop it in there, its view, its, you know, view or understanding of water is completely different than ours. You could say, well, do fish even have an understanding? Well, they have a mind, it looks like. It's a maybe more primitive kind of mind. But they, maybe we could say their experience of the water is completely different. It's like air is for us. And like our experience of air is very different from a fish. A fish's experience of air is kind of like water is for us, in the sense that neither one can breathe in the other's element. So right there we have sentient beings, we have living beings that experience what looks to be this thing that we just assume is something that you drink, bathe in, wash things with, and swim in and sail in. For a fish, it's like their palace, it's like their home. Likewise, for, say, like the body, to bring it even more directly into our immediate experience. So we experience our body in a certain way, and even visually, we can only look at it from like our eyes can only, you know, we can't even quite see like maybe our butt and certain areas on our, like our back, we can't really see it except in a mirror, but we see it from this funny view that nobody else sees it from, and other people see it from a different view. So we experience it differently, and different people will see bodies in a different way. If somebody's your friend or your enemy, they'll see your body in a different way. If they're a man or a woman, if they're gay or straight or whatever, they're going to see bodies in different ways. So it's not fixed thing, the body. And animal, like a tiger, will see a body in a very different way than any human will. It's like, you're food. And you might think, well, these days we're not often food. But actually, an insect will see your body. A mosquito will see your body in quite a different way than any other people will. I mean, is it even the same thing? When you imagine being a mosquito, we can't quite do it, but they really see it as like something completely different. Maybe like we would see like a an apple tree or something to eat from. So these are classic examples given by the founders of this mind-only school in a very simple way to point out how what we call the external world of bodies and water and things like this are not fixed realities. In fact, they're not actually external objects, the school is saying. They are actually made by the mind, as the Buddha said. You could say, well, is there something there that the mind is interpreting in different ways? But to say, you know, from our point of view, like the water, we say, well, there really is this water, and just fish don't see it quite right. We have the true take on what water is. And I think we naturally do that about everything. We think we have the real way. And so like traveling in other cultures is great for this, because you think like people are so weird here, but then you see like, well, you're the only one who's not doing it that way. So this school and the sutras and treatises of this school will go into the intricacies of convincing us more and more deeply that what we call the external world is not the external world, that it's actually mind only. And it's good to remember this too when we, going back to the discussion about you know, bending over and walking around the zendo in this jundo and doing these different kinds of bows and things, thinking like, that's crazy. But, and you know, last night we did this eye-opening ceremony for this new statue of Manjushri Bodhisattva, where we intentionally like put life into these, you know, wooden and plaster statues. Very strange, but from the perspective of mind only, such things are possible. That actually, if we put life, if our intention, with our intention, we put life into something, then there's life there. So intention is one aspect of mind that actually also, we could say, creates the world. Everything we can see around us was created by human intention. Well, I guess you could say, well, think, you know, this was created by humans to design it and so on, but actually, and it has a vertical dimension of, it has an ancient design, it has a horizontal dimension that was made very recently. And but also, there was a tree involved. So we didn't really create the tree, but we have basically like, we've put our mind into like all these trees to make all these wooden things around that we forget that they were even trees. So we're really intention and mind have created the space, and then our interpretation, once we have all these physical, so-called physical objects, then we perceive them all differently. Like, who knows how you see this thing. So, I better stop. I'm still ahead. Do you have anything to bring up about vertical, horizontal, trees, water, bodies or practice period or anything else. Then let's go have tea. It's been a long night. And I hope that that we can all thoroughly enjoy this 9 weeks and this next year for people who are going to be around for the next year. All kinds of things will happen in the next year. We have no idea what they're going to be. But actually, there isn't really a year out there. This is something that the mind has made up a concept called a year. It doesn't really exist out there. And if we think that it exists and we just entered this year-long program, we might be terrified. So just remember, it's mind only. We dedicate any merit arising from opening this year of practice and opening this 9-week practice period to the complete, perfect peace and freedom for all beings. May everyone realize mind only and live compassionately and openly with such a heart. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. Yeah.